Hello and welcome to Better Construction with Sean McStay, the podcast where we discuss design and construction techniques, products, and details that lead to a better built environment. All right, and welcome to this week's episode of Better Construction. This week, I am thrilled to have on the show Peter Yost. Peter is the owner of Building Right and the technical director at Green Building Advisor. So, Peter, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Sean. Happy to be here.
Awesome. So for people who are listening to the show who maybe aren't familiar with you, maybe do a quick intro.
Sure. So I have 10 brothers and sisters, six brothers, and just about all of them have been involved in the construction industry. So I was teaching high school science and seemed like a lot more fun to go full-time when I was working with my brothers pretty much as a construction laborer during the summers when I wasn't teaching. And had a bit of a health problem and couldn't work on the job site anymore. So went back to graduate school and finished up a degree on resource economics, but focusing on construction waste management. And that led to a lot of contact with folks at the NAHB Research Center, which is the National Association of Home Builders Research Center. Now the, having trouble remembering the new business name for that organization. But in any event, I got paid to research the stuff that I didn't understand when I was building. That felt pretty good. But then I went from there to working for Building Green, one of the oldest running monthly publications in the U.S. for the building industry and the environment. And then from there to my second round of learning about buildings at Building Science Corporation with Joe Stiebrick and Betsy Pettit. And then, you know, a longstanding relationship with Green Building Advisor. We developed that information resource with Taunton Press when I was at Building Green. And, you know, we spent about 2 years developing that. And then that's why I'm still the technical director there. And it's just a great resource. It's been a lot of fun to work on that over the years. So I do a lot of building investigations, trainings, design and spec review for architects and builders. I teach at a couple different places, and it all leads to enabling my attention deficit. So
nice. It's a very thorough intro. I appreciate that. It sounds like so 10 brothers and sisters, that alone is very interesting by itself, but the majority of them is being in the construction industry. Is there a history before kind of your generation of being in construction, or was that just kind of organically happen?
That's really funny. My father was a Lutheran minister and he grew up on a farm. But I learned pretty late in life that my father's mother's father, so my great-grandfather, was a Pennsylvania home builder. Hmm. And I didn't know that until long after I had been involved in construction. But a lot of us just, I think all of us have some sort of teaching degree, but really like to build stuff. So, you know, most of my brothers are older than I am, and I always looked up to what they were up to and really went to the job site just to be with my brothers. And, you know, then ended up really liking construction, but not really understanding it until I went to the research center and then to Building Science Corporation. And, you know, just love the way that they work. I love how complex yet simple they can be. So.
Very cool. Yeah, it's neat that you dove so deep into obviously the building science side of things, coming from the construction background. I guess I'll start off with kind of a very broad question, but being that you're, you know, known to be an expert on this and certainly credentialed to be an expert on this, why isn't everyone building better right now?
Yeah, well, I think in part it comes back to, I'm just going to give you a real quick story about, I was working for a company that was doing energy and comfort guarantees. And, you know, you can't build high-performance buildings unless you can market them. And so we did a whole bunch of focus groups across the United States, I think 6 different locations and 3 different groups, first-time buyers, move-up buyers, and luxury buyers. And we had 10 potential home buyers in each of the focus groups. And the facilitator was instructed, you know, don't bring up performance until we tell you to. And so in every location across all three buyer types, no one ever brought up building performance when asked, you know, tell us a little bit about, you know, what you think about the home you live in and the home you'd like to live in. And then we would buzz the facilitator and say, oh, you know, as an indication, okay, no one's brought it up after 45 minutes, bring up performance. When we did that, we couldn't get them to shut up about, oh yeah, the bonus room over the garage. Why is it always so cold in the winter and so warm in the summer? And this sort of like dam was broken with them about all the ways they thought homes didn't perform right. So why is that? Well, for the single largest purchase in our lives, most of us don't make a connection to performance or are terrified of how, you know, it's like the buildings are so complicated. I really don't want to know what's going on behind the walls because it all seems a bit like magic to me. When I do building investigations, this happens quite a bit that someone will call and say, well, I've been doing some research on the internet, and I think after about 3 weeks, I understand the building less than I did before, but still more than my builder or my architect. Hmm. That is a tough recipe. And I'm as guilty of this as anybody. You know, the joke on the website, on our job sites, when my brothers and I would get to a flashing problem we didn't understand, it's like, you know, 24 years of higher education down the drain. We can't figure out how to flash this. So I didn't understand building science or building performance at all when I was a practitioner. And a lot of it comes back to, we should be thinking of our homes and our buildings as performance items, but that's not how we're sort of trained. And then on the professional side, you know, there's a complete void in many high schools, trade schools, four-year colleges, graduate schools in building science. You can graduate from a lot of five-year architectural programs and not take any building science classes at all. So I think that you can pretty easily shift buyers to thinking of their homes as performance items, like they do their cars, their computers, or their phones. The education of our building professionals, that's a longer haul.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that the educational opportunities out there are in some ways more available and more prevalent now than they have been in a long time. The information is there. And so that's part of the reason why I asked the question is, you know, the information is there. We know it's better. We know it does cost a bit more depending on exactly what, you know, high performance means in that area, but it almost always costs a little bit more, sometimes a lot depending. But a lot of people still are very hesitant against it. And I think you've hit the nail on the head with the education side of things. So, I mean, I obviously in my day job sell airtight building products, and I still have a lot of people very smart, intelligent, hardworking, want to build a good place, mm-hmm. builders asking me, yeah, but if I make the walls airtight, you know, isn't that bad for the health of the people inside? So that kind of missing of knowledge, how do we fix that? What are some of the ways that we can influence the industry?
Yeah, I mean, you brought up a really good example. I mean, I think one of the hardest things to explain to both building professionals and lay people is, all right, I'm gonna spend all this time and money making the building more airtight. And then that means I have to ventilate it. Like, I'm sorry, why didn't we just leave it leaky? And so, I mean, it sounds like a business plan for an HVAC firm, right? Is to tighten up the building. So then we have to add mechanical ventilation. And a lot of this has to do, you know, Steve and I just got done doing a Unbuild It podcast with Jake. And I really like the way that Steve and the approach of his architectural work says, it's all about control, right? If you have things happening in your building that are by happenstance or by climate dictate, you don't have control over that. And as we make buildings more energy efficient, we have to have more control over the whole process. So what's the difference between just having a leaky home and installing ventilation? When you install ventilation, you know how much air is coming in, you know how often, and you know from where. Well, that's control, right? So, you know, that is, I think, scary to a lot of building professionals. Certainly the first time I went through an in-depth two-day training with Joe Stiebrick, I was terrified by the end of the first day, you know, just because I thought I understood how buildings worked and I was getting my head handed to me on a platter about just, and I had taught high school science. You know, the stuff that Joe does in his trainings, you know, he's a PhD in engineering, but he brings it down to sort of a high school physics level quite often, which is one of part of his magic. So it's a bit of an uphill push to tell building professionals, no, building science is not simple, but it's unavoidable. And what you want to do is try to transfer it as simply as you can into your buildings. But it's kind of scary. When you look at codes, for instance, especially the most recent codes, there's always a prescriptive path and a performance path. And the prescriptive path is like, I'm done. I'm done listening to all this. Please just tell me what to do, right? That's prescription. And then there's a bunch of building professionals who say, well, don't you dare tell me what to do. Tell me what you want and I'll figure out how to do it. That's my job. So, you know, the two pathways in the code are because I think we need to move more to performance-based, because that's a lot easier, I think, to stay out of trouble than if you rely upon prescription. Because in prescription, if you get one little thing wrong and you don't know the importance of that lever, then, you know, that's much more dangerous than understanding the way things work and then trying to figure it out for your particular building.
Exactly. I mean, I think that's, you know, I'm pretty heavily involved with Passive House, and I think that's one of the benefits of Passive House is that there is testing to be done. There was a really interesting PHBP model that a local architect here did, and basically had a single family home that had Passive House windows, the right amount of insulation, no thermal bridging, etc., and had it at 0.6 air changes per hour. And the energy load was like 11 kilowatt hours. So it was within Passive House requirements. He took that same house and bumped it up to 5.5 air changes per hour, but left the windows and insulation and everything else the same. And it doubled the energy load or the heating and cooling requirements for that home. Just so that if you had those prescriptive standards with no testing and you didn't know that you were at 5.5, you thought you were, you know, you did all the things technically to try and hit 0.6. You know, that's a massive difference. So I agree with you. I think performance-based standards are definitely required. That does lead into my next question, though. With code, there's a big argument always about we should make these things voluntary or we should make these things required. I tend to be on the side of required. I look at other industries like the automotive industry, electronics industry, etc. Big changes didn't really happen until it was required. Where do you stand on that when it comes to the construction industry?
Yeah, well, I do think that we need to raise the base level performance of buildings. I'm a little leery of trusting the codes to do that because we don't have a terribly good history of that, especially since, you know, we've made mistakes over the years with ramping up energy performance without proper respect for the connection to moisture management. So I'm a little bit leery of the codes. I do think that if we do get people to shift to understanding their purchase of buildings the same way that they purchase cars or phones or laptops, that's going to help an awful lot, because it doesn't take much of a shift to get people to say, well, my neighbor's got this house that's, you know, works really well in terms of indoor air quality as well as energy performance. How are you going to deliver that to me? So I'm pretty strongly of the opinion that we need carrots and sticks, right? That the code helps to bring the baseline up, but you can't through requirements and legislation really move to high performance until the market is pulling it along. And I think programs like Passive House and, you know, Lead for Homes and higher performance programs, the energy bill programs that used to be more common across the U.S. and are still out there. You know, if you tell somebody you're going to guarantee their heating bill that or their space conditioning bill, that does get their attention. And so that might not be what drives all the performance, but it certainly is a good hook to plant.
Yeah, I agree. I think the marketing part that you mentioned, like the actual getting the consumers to understand, I think part of the reason too, personally, is consumers have been told, you know, whether it's on TV or whatever else that they're getting their construction knowledge from sometimes, that, you know, this house was built to code, as if that's like the gold standard of the way the building should be built, rather than this house was built to the bare minimum standard legally allowable. It's not going to fall down on you and you probably won't freeze to death. Like if we sold cars the way that sometimes people sell the code for houses, I don't think people would walk in, buy a new pickup, and it's got the least amount of brakes we're allowed to put on it, the smallest engine, and you're probably not going to light on fire. But you know, other than that, we don't know how this is going to go. When it comes to that marketing, I know there's been a big push to kind of demystify some of the building science. You know, turn things from, you know, you put an ERV into, you know, Gord Cook says, you know, you put a fresh air machine in the building. How do you think builders can kind of take that on and communicate that to their clients in a way their clients understand?
Yeah. I've always been particularly attracted to the guarantee approach. We were working on a program actually with Fannie Mae back in about 1999 or 2000, where we were trying to figure out how to guarantee energy, thermal comfort, water efficiency, and durability. And the program never really went anywhere, at least as far as I know, within Fannie Mae. But the idea was that if you put in requirements for performance that attract people's attention from a financial perspective. You know, the really interesting thing about those programs are that they're all written with clauses that say, before, you know, if you make a claim on our guarantee and you want to get, you know, your money back, written into the contract, it says, we reserve the right to come in to try to fix it, you know, rather than pay you the difference between the guaranteed amount and what your bill was. Invariably, people said, I don't really care about the money. I just want to know why it's not working the way that it should. So fascinating that everyone, if they made a claim, was way more interested in figuring out why it didn't get to the guarantee than getting their money back. And that's a huge, you know, because that means that you're being invited to go back into your buildings and figure out what didn't go right. You know, the most builders, after their 1 year warranty period, the last thing they want to do is go back and look at their projects, right? But when you think about it, if you maintain a relationship with the owner such that you get pulled back in to see how it worked, you know, that's valuable information. There was a builder at the research center who was in his 80s when we worked with him, a guy named Bob Schmidt from Ohio. And he said, I'm a family businessman. I'm a third generation home builder in this town in Ohio. Those homes are still my homes. So he had a lot of interest in going back into the buildings. So I think part of it too is this, you know, if you have a 100,000 mile guarantee on the transmission, you're having a much longer relationship with that car, you know, than just doing a 1 year guarantee. So I do think the marketing tool of a guarantee is a hook for the consumer, but it also promotes a longer-term relationship between the person who built the product and the person who currently owns it. And I think that's a powerful approach to building.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that I don't know if it's the same way in the U.S., but I know in Canada, certain places, there's, you know, construction companies that are set up to build a subdivision, and then that company is kept around for just long enough to meet the new home warranty requirements. Then they shut that company down and start a different company up. And that's kind of a matter of practice, not even like, you know, that's one odd outlier. So I think having some sort of long-term relationship between the builder and the person occupying the space definitely will help with that. shifting gears a little bit, if sure. you have a builder that is like, okay, I want to build better. I want to do, some sort of high performance construction. From your experience, where are some of the areas that typically trip them up the first time that they're doing that?
Yeah. I think that, the mantra I use in trainings is manage energy and moisture with equal intensity. Because moisture flows and heat flows are linked. It's not an option. That's just the way that it is. So when I see builders getting into trouble, and even a lot of trade contractors, particularly insulation companies, if you don't honor that relationship, it's pretty easy to get into trouble pretty quickly. The other thing is that, we get a lot of fascination with vapor management and, what type of vapor retarder. And that is so far down the list of importance of management. If you're going to build more energy efficient buildings, before you do that, you got to get bulk water under control, and you got to get all the capillary continuities broken with capillary breaks, and then air tightness. So those are three forms of moisture movement that are way more significant than vapor diffusion. And yet we sort of have this fascination, actually promoted by the code, particularly in cold climates, of, hey, if you just get this one layer right in the wall, you're all done. And that's like the least important thing. So, the trainings that that Steve and I do, and that each of us does on our own, it's all about walking builders through priorities. Here are the things that you have to get done correctly first. When I do building investigations, I go after it exactly the same way. I'll get a client saying, there's a moisture problem in the bathroom. And I say, I'm going to walk the outside of your buildings first. Why would you walk the outside of the building? The moisture is in the bathroom. And it's because, it may end up there, but that's not necessarily where the moisture came from. So, that prioritization of moisture in a building is a really important place to start, because that way you can get right the big ones before you move on to the more intricate ones.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. There's a lot of municipalities that I work with that are absolutely, hooked on the exact vapor permeance of this, vapor control layer. But I ask them, are you doing a blower door test on these to determine air tightness? No. Well, 100 times more moisture, depending on where you live, go through convection than through diffusion. So you should really be much more concerned about that. So I completely agree. The kind of holistic approach is pretty necessary.
The other thing we do locally is we have a builders guild that meets once a month. And, even if you have a good training series, the translation of what you learn to your individual jobs is hard, especially the first times through. So the beauty of we call it SEON, S-E-O-N, for Sustainable Energy Outreach Network. But the Builder Guild meetings once a month for 3 hours, it's like road testing what you've learned. And, the thing you have to break down is who's going to raise their hand and say, I have this project and I'm not really sure how it works. That's embarrassing. But if everybody checks in hey, we're all trying to learn together. If you break down that barrier of, not only working by yourself, Levinson has this quote of, you have to learn from the mistakes of others. You can't possibly live long enough to make them all yourself.
That makes sense for sure.
Implementation of the building scientist is probably scarier than learning it.
So when people are looking at, picking up more knowledge, more information, obviously, we've already mentioned the Green Building Advisor. You guys have a pretty dedicated to building science podcast, the Unbuild It podcast. What are some of the other resources that you'd recommend people take a look at?
Yeah. I have a series of resources that I always give out as a handout. And it starts with buildingscience.com. Joe and Betsy, largely through the Building America program, have made just tons and tons and years of research available for free on the internet. they could have monetized that website a long time ago and they never have. So they deserve a lot of credit for, you know, keeping it in the commons. The Building America Solution Center is climate specific, 20 plus years of research in the US on high performance by climate. That's a great resource. For architects, there's a book called Designing the Exterior Wall by Linda Brock. A great text for architects because it's very focused on performance and focuses both on representative residential light frame assemblies as well as commercial. Most architectural references do very short shrift to residential buildings. It's almost always commercial. And, you know, for building science reading, Bill Rose has the book Water and Buildings. It's still one of the most intriguing, nerdy, but powerful, well-written books that I'm aware of. And Bill's interesting because he's sort of a building science historian as well as a, you know, a terrific building professional in his own right. For commercial buildings, it's the Whole Building Design Guide, which is on the internet. And that is a tremendous resource on the commercial building side. From an environmental perspective, you know, I think that Green Building Advisor is one of the best for residential buildings. And then buildinggreen.com is one of the best for commercial buildings, in my opinion.
Yeah, those are some fantastic resources for sure. And I'll put links in the description for as many of those as I can as well. As I get towards the end of these episodes, listeners know there's always kind of two questions that I ask. The first one is kind of a fun question because you get a magic wand for it. But if you could wave that magic wand and get rid of any one misconception about building science, which one would it be for you?
Wow. Wave my magic wand and get rid of a misconception. I guess I would have to say on the fly, the misconceptions between quote unquote air barriers and vapor barriers. That would be one of my top to get rid of.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we can just get rid of the term air vapor barrier entirely because they're not always the same thing. But yep. That's a very good one.
It can be, but Yeah.
The second question is a personal interest one for me. Now, you've already mentioned a few, but I always do ask if you could recommend a book, personal or professional, either, which one would it be for you?
Yeah. So I'm trying to think outside of the ones that I've mentioned. There's probably for cold climate, I would say John Straub's High Performance Enclosures for Cold Climates. He's never done one, I don't think, for the rest of the climates, but that text, you know, we're lucky to have Joe Stiebrick and John Straub, and with him, Chris Schumacher, all Canadians, by the way, John's book on commercial construction is just, I go back to it over and over again. And by the way, that reminds me of John's text called Building Science for Building Enclosures, which is, I don't even think available anymore. That was a first edition and none subsequent. That book I go back to all the time. And it's interesting because there are about 9 chapters that I understand completely because they're not architectural engineering. And then there's about 9 chapters that I struggle through all the time. But that's the beauty of the book, is that if you want to delve into the math and the deep science behind it, you can, but he's got half the book that's accessible to all of us. So Building Science for Building Enclosures would be, to me, sort of like a Bible.
Perfect. Great. Well, Peter, thank you so much for your time being on the show today. For everyone listening and watching on YouTube, I'll go ahead and put links below for Peter's social media, the Unbuild It podcast, as well as his company. And with that, Peter, I hope you have a great rest of your day.
Nice talking to you, Sean. Thanks very much.